Welcome to the Inside OSU podcast. I'm Robin Hearn. Technology continues to evolve. As we've witnessed revolution in communication technology in the past 10 years, what the next 10 years hold can be more transformative. Can also be extremely disruptive and challenging the long-held conventions behind public diplomacy programs and strategies. Dr. Sean Powers, the Chief Strategy Officer of the United States Agency for Global Media, sat down with Dr. Randy Kluver to speak as part of the Global Briefing Series to discuss the effects of technology and the internet in the field of public diplomacy. Take a listen.
I know you've recently taken up a new position with the U.S. Agency for Global Media. Can you talk a little bit about what the AGM is and does?
The U.S. Agency for Global Media is a modernized agency. It used to be known as the Broadcasting Board of Governors, and we are an independent federal agency that oversees five public service news networks, the largest of which is Voice of America, and includes Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia, and a couple other broadcasters as well. We have a unique and simple mission, which is to engage citizens around the world in support of freedom and democracy, which is wonderful because we can really focus and prioritize on what kinds of programs are most likely to actually increase access to information and foster democratic dialogue. We do so through a free and independent press. And so we have about 3,000 plus journalists that work for our networks. They have guaranteed legislative independence from politicians, so no one at the State Department, no one at the White House can tell them what to cover or how to cover it. And they really prioritize reporting from countries where there is not a free and independent press or where the economic situation is not sustainable for independent media. So think about Iraq, you think about Sudan. We've got robust reporting about Korea from South Korea, countries where you really need external resources to support access to information.
Now, the agency in its previous, under its previous name, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, has been in existence for decades, right?
Absolutely. So the Broadcasting Board of Governors was established when the U.S. Information Agency splits, went away, and the traditional public diplomacy efforts of USIA, which includes exchange programs and sort of press operations, merged into the State Department. And at that time, Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, broke off into a separate independent agency named the Broadcasting Board of Governors. We've since now added three additional news networks.
Terrific. And it's such a critical role in helping to establish norms for journalism and media freedom around the world.
Yeah, it's a fun job. And and one of the really cool things is we're a unique federal agency whose mission is to put ourselves out of business. And what I mean by that is we aim to support free and independent press in each of the countries we operate in. And if the local press is robust and sufficient to cover local politics without the need of U.S. AGM, then we actually pull out of the market, which we've done in a number of places, especially in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War. And it's amazingly gratifying to know that the work that we do can actually change not just access to information, but also journalistic professionalism in countries to such an extent where we could say, okay, you've got it from here. We're going to focus our resources somewhere else.
That's terrific. Now, in a previous life, of course, you were an academic. You were a tenured professor at Georgia State University, working in communication, media, and international studies. How did you make that transition into government work?
Yeah, the glory days, right? I miss academia so much. It's wonderful. Part of my life, and I always will think of myself as an academic. I mean, I'm drawn to the big research-based questions, and I think that really has helped me in government, frankly, because it's hard for folks to get their heads around the vast quantities of data that we have access to, and so as an academic, we're sort of trained to think critically about how to use information to ask the right questions and hopefully provide solutions to some thorny issues. I've always thought about structuring my research as an academic, not just in terms of questions that I found interesting, but questions that I knew other folks needed help with as well. And so my scholarship always focused on real-world problems, including the future of internet freedom and what is the proper and responsible role for an international broadcaster to be playing a public service-like mission, but at the same time depend on state funding. And it's really hard. You know, why would a government want to fund a global news network if that news network doesn't toe that government's party line, right? What incentive does a government have? And so a lot of my research has always been about demonstrating the value, in this case, of free and independent press and supporting those institutions to the global security environment, to the United States government, and to governments around the world, and focused a lot of my research resources on answering those questions. And so in so doing, I published a number of articles that I think resonated with folks at the State Department, was asked to start working on a couple of projects, which at the time I just thought was fun. It turns out that they were long interviews, basically.
Grooming you for a job.
Yeah. And it eventually it became clear that they were trying to bring me on board and join the State Department on a temporary basis. I took leave from Georgia State University. They were very gracious in offering me some time off. And as soon as I got to the State Department and just saw the kind of scope of the challenges that we face and the possibilities of really turning all of the work I'd been doing as an academic into actionable solutions and really being at the front lines of some of these big questions, I couldn't help but jump at it. And I don't regret the decision. I miss academia, but obviously I do love my job now as well.
Well, good. We're glad you're in that position. So your professional career has coincided with some really epic changes in the global political landscape. I know your early work was on Arabic language media, Al Jazeera. Of course, in 2001, we suddenly discovered the term public diplomacy.
Yeah.
And it became very important, the idea of reaching foreign audiences to help them understand U.S. policy and so on and so forth. But you've also been active during the rise of the internet, or the multiple internets, the various technologies, digital technologies, which has completely transformed how we get news, how we order our lives, how we buy airline tickets, really every aspect of our lives.
Yeah.
And then finally, in the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen really a marked increase in global competition with the People's Republic of China, with Russia. How do you see your role now as, in a sense, riding that wave, as if it were, or even trying to address those fundamental challenges?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something that's occupying more and more of my time on a daily basis. When I started writing about internet freedom, it was a space that the U.S. government was absolutely dominant in. You know, the internet freedom movement was something that had robust support from civil society groups inside the United States, but the U.S. government as well. And no country had a chance to compete with us. We had the best technology, really bright minds, had years and years of strategy and development. And what we've seen since then is a lack of focus, almost no strategic thread that combines U.S. government internet freedom programs, and just a tremendous amount of resources and strategy by some adversarial governments, China and Russia in particular. Yeah. Our estimates have the Chinese government putting billions of dollars into new technologies that allow for surveillance, active tracking of everything online, and really active control of the online environment. And the U.S. government spends somewhere in the realm of $60 to $70 million per year. We're not spending enough to keep up. But even before we get to the money question, we don't have a strategy. We don't have a unifying theme that says, here's where we are, and here's where we want to go, and here's why. And recognizing that, the U.S. Agency for Global Media this year, which has a small piece of that internet freedom puzzle. We've got about $15 million to support new tools that help our audiences access information. We decided it was time for someone to step up. And so we've made a pitch to Congress that we should actually create a new organization called the Open Technology Fund, and that new organization would receive additional funding and provide a leadership role across the U.S. government and across civil society to really make us a lot more competitive in this space. The Senate in particular was very supportive of this, and I suspect it's going to be a big part of the work that we do moving forward. One of the reasons why the pitch to Congress was so effective is the reason why internet freedom work needs to be done at my agency is we can make the tools in-house, we can develop those tools in-house, and we can deploy them with our journalists and with our audiences and get real-time feedback in some of the most difficult environments in the world. And no one else across the U.S. government can guarantee a direct path to getting these technologies in the field and a direct path to hear about how those technologies are working. And that having that feedback loop built into the process gives us a tremendous advantage in taking these technologies to market at lightning speed compared to what we've been able to do so far.
I think one of the things I find most interesting here is the confluence of technologies with political values. and you're trying to develop technologies with sort of a baked-in political value of openness and freedom, whereas other governments are trying to build in very different technological infrastructures. How do you see that playing out in the next 10, 15 years?
Yeah, it's a great point. It's something I think we need to be more open and honest about. Mm-hmm. Technology is not neutral. No technology is neutral. Every technology has politics baked into it one way or another. And I think we need to be honest about the politics that are baked into our technologies. Mm-hmm. One of the tools that my office incubated a couple years ago is called Signal, which is a highly secure private messaging app that's built on some robust encryption protocols that have since become the protocols that back WhatsApp, Skype, and Facebook Messenger. They're basically the industry standard for privacy technology at this point. And so we get to say, and I like to say this a lot, that 2.2 billion cell phones around the world have US AGM incubated technology installed on them. And that's something we have to own. We will always support open source technology. Nothing that we support can be proprietary or used to make for profit, basically. It has to be open source and available to the rest of the sector. Mm-hmm. Everything we have prioritizes security of the individual, and nothing we create allows for surveillance, either from the U.S. government or from any other entity. And those are the values that are baked into our technologies because we think that they're essential to a free and independent society, free and open press.
Sure, yeah. So let me change gears just a little bit. You're in a highly diplomatic arena in terms of you're in Washington, D.C. You've got really the focus of the world there. You work very closely with your colleagues at State Department as well as other U.S. government agencies. What role do you see artificial intelligence playing in the future of diplomacy, in the future of statecraft, in the future of even military conflict?
Yeah, a big role. And it's one that I think the U.S. government's been very hesitant to really dive into. Mm-hmm. There are pockets of investment and pockets of thinking and deep interest in AI across the U.S. government. But again, if you ask yourself, what is the strategy? What are the guidelines for how AI should be approached? What are the ethical parameters for AI tools that we want to integrate? Mm-hmm. And what are we trying to achieve? We simply don't have those conversations maturing to the extent that we need to be competitive in this space because we see in the field other governments using these tools for a variety of purposes, many of which are to the detriment of our national security, to be quite frank. And so we have to double down, invest in these tools, and think carefully about how they can be helpful, and in particular, how can they create efficiencies that then free up people's time to then do more difficult work? Because AI can do a lot of analysis. AI can streamline a lot of workflows. But AI is not going to help us engage person to person on the streets of Beijing. You know, AI is not going to help us persuade folks to come to American universities for their PhDs. Mm-hmm. That's human engagement. But but AI can solve a lot of problems that people, human beings, spend a lot of time on. I mean, a remarkable amount of time on, including streamlining workflows, but also detecting, you know, fraudulent contracts and that sort of thing, which, again, a lot of folks in the U.S. government spend a lot of time on. We need to use AI tools to deal some really big thorny issues. The DoD, of course, is thinking about these in the context of warfare, which is important as well. Sure. But not all of it's got to be super sexy. Not all of it's got to be headline news. Some of it can be AI tools that are already built by Microsoft and other providers that can just make us much smarter about how we use our time. And frankly, integrate AI tools into the culture of the State Department and the U.S. Agency for Global Media so that folks are much more familiar with the technology. Right now, if I bring up AI, half of my colleagues think I'm talking about the Terminator. and there is a fear around technology in general and about artificial intelligence in particular that it's a cultural fear. And we really need to help folks understand not only the tools and the possibilities, but also what is our approach to these tools so that people feel comfortable and they don't feel like we're trying to, you know, take their jobs from them or lose control over these technologies themselves.
Sure. So one of the things that's very interesting, of course, is that the U.S. economic model is often predicated upon technological development is driven by the private sector, not the government.
Yeah.
But historically, it's been government investment that drove a lot of the life-changing technologies, including air travel, rocket travel, the rise of the internet, and so on and so forth. But we often think, no, we need to leave that to Microsoft or to Google. They should take the lead on that, right? But yet other countries see the state as having a much more prominent role.
Yeah.
Among the U.S. allies, what's the attitude, say, France and Germany and Britain? What is their attitude towards government investment towards these technologies?
It's a good question. I don't have exact figures off the top of my head, but I don't sense... My sense is that most of our European allied governments are in a similar boat as the U.S. government, which is to say, recognizing the significance of these tools, but not fully on track to compete in this space. The market question you raised is a really good one, and I kind of want to comment on that quickly, which is, you know, private sector is wonderful for developing a number of technologies and number of tools. But what we've seen is AI tools in particular, when driven by market incentives, which is to say for-profit incentives, are not necessarily all that valuable for the work that governments do, and frankly, don't really maximize what AI is capable of.
Sure.
You know, unfortunately, there's a lot of money in the surveillance business. There's a lot of money in the advertising business. And so you see a lot of AI tools applied in surveillance and advertising. I don't care about advertising. The government doesn't need ads to support its model, and I'm against surveillance. And so, you know, from my perspective, AI is uniquely suited for a substantial public investment, because if it's left to the private sector or foreign governments, the tools that we know are we're capable of producing simply won't be available to us.
Mm-hmm. You've got a fascinating title. I love it. Chief Strategy Officer for the Agency for Global Media. And that means that you're really at the sector of thinking about what is the future like, and looking at current trends, looking at current capacities, current capabilities, and trying to chart out the future.
Yeah.
Where do you think your agency will be 10 years from now?
Yeah, it is a question I spend a lot of time thinking about, and it's the most fun part of my job, obviously, is trying to get above the day-to-day weeds. One of the things that I've had my team focused on for the past couple of months is a project called The Future of Distribution. So you look around the world, and you quickly realize the ways in which information flows from country A to country B are changing dramatically. You know, we went from primarily telegraph and radio signals for large parts of the 20th century to an internet-based kind of global communication ecosystem more recently. And that ecosystem is about to get a lot more complicated and interesting with things like 5G, 6G, low Earth orbit satellites, digital shortwave technologies, which are a combination of digital and shortwave transmissions. And right now, it's unclear to us which of these platforms are going to dominate in which parts of the world, and if there is going to be a consensus on which standards are going to be used. And so from the agency's perspective, we have to invest in all of them, and we have to be agile and be able to hop from one to another if and when a particular market gets tricky. If the government shuts down the internet, for example, we have to rev up our shortwave transmitters because that's the best way to get information into a country when it's gone data dark, basically.
Yeah.
And my boss doesn't like this answer because it means we've got to invest in a lot of different tools and technologies, and it means continued investment.
Sure.
But it's the only way to prepare for the next 10 years because anyone who says they know what the world's global communication ecosystem looks like in 5 or 10 years has no idea what they're talking about.
Well, I think of Joel Perry Barlow's famous Declaration of Independence for Cyberspace 15, 20 years ago, and just how incredibly naive it seems when you read it today.
It was a wonderful concept. it's just not real.
It's just not real.
We're
facing a very different world now.
Yeah.
So let me pull it back around to the universities. You're, of course, in Washington, D.C. You've got a lot of universities in the D.C. area. We're in Stillwater, and we're training students to be bright young leaders in their chosen fields. But earlier today, you met with some of our students, and you talked to them about really what does it take to prepare for a career of global impact. Can you hit some of the highlights from as you think about giving advice to students? How do they prepare for a future? What would be the best advice you'd give them?
Yeah, thanks. I think it's a fascinating question because you go back in your own history and you kind of ask yourself what could I do better? You know. But you know, first and foremost, and I've said this to a number of your wonderful students, is do everything you can to enjoy the experience you have right now. And I really mean that sincerely. I don't have time in my days to read a book. I know you don't have time in your days, most of the days, to read books or articles, to be current on the literature. Some amazing research is being done out there. And you know, once you get on the professional fast track, it's just really difficult to carve out the time for these big conversations and kind of thorough reads. And graduate school is that unique opportunity where your job is literally to do just that. And so I think it's hard when students are running from class to class and from extracurricular activity to, you know, graduate student assignments to papers and exams, it's hard to just enjoy that your job is to learn and think carefully and keep on learning. And first and foremost, it's to kind of take a breath and say, okay, this is exactly what I'm supposed to be doing, and I need to find ways to enjoy it as much as I can, because the rest of my life is not going to be like this. Mm-hmm. And then from there is just really finding your passion and being proactive about chasing it down. So figuring out, you know, what part of the field you see yourself contributing in, and what is your contribution, both as a person, you know, where do you think you can add value, solve a problem, make people think differently on a question that's been really slowing folks down, and how does your experience, your time at Oklahoma State, your personal experience, your work history, give you leverage in that conversation? How do you say, I can help you solve this problem because I've been thinking about it and because I understand the issue from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And embracing that entirety of the persona that is required, I think, to really be a leader and come out of graduate school and be ready to jump into the professional core, be it nonprofit, government, or academic.
Terrific. So I'm going to take that clip and I'm going to show it at all of our student orientations at this point and say... one final question. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about having deep experience as a university faculty member, doing research in these very fields. Now you're, of course, in a very different field in the government. What can universities do better to really tackle some of these big issues? And I'm thinking not just in terms of the research, the preparation for the students, but the other ways in which the universities might really help to strengthen the efforts of the United States and our allies to really create a more stable global order?
That's a great question. I had a great experience at Georgia State and am still thrilled by how supportive they were of my work. And not every academic institution would be as supportive. You know, not to get too deep in the weeds on the tenure process, but, you know, there are a number of universities whose tenure processes really judge folks based on a specific set of academic criteria, and work that's policy relevant is not often considered as all that valuable, and that's a huge problem, because at an early age you're structured to think about policy relevant work as tertiary to the academic enterprise, and that I think is to the detriment of the United States, is to the detriment of our society. Truly, I mean, beyond the kind of national security perspective, just engaging with the policy process is what all scholars should do, and the ways in which promotion is incentivized at most universities, it does not allow for those conversations. And so I think that has to be part of the conversation. So thinking about promoting people not just based on the number of peer-reviewed articles, but also the number of policy reports that have shaped policy conversations is crucially important. I love this example. So earlier this year, I commissioned a report of five academics, journalism professors, to assess one of our networks, and gave them complete independence. They reviewed the clips on their own and basically gave them a couple of questions to answer, but really told them, you can be happy, you can be critical, you can decide on your own, whatever you guys want. And they came back with a really compelling report on how to fix our Office of Cuba Broadcasting, which broadcasts from Miami into Cuba. The report was terribly critical of the current effort. I mean, so critical that it was sort of like, you know, sometimes professors can be super critical of graduate student papers. They kind of felt like that wrath was coming out.
Yeah.
But of course we went straight ahead and said, we committed to publishing this publicly. We're going to, you know, publish it publicly, even though it's very critical of our own work. That report has since spun up a entire modernization effort to rebuild the Office of Cuba Broadcasting from scratch. It was cited by two different pieces of congressional legislation, which is phenomenal, right? You think about an academic report actually being cited in law as a reason to support a modernization effort.
It's never happened with my research.
and me neither. And I just, it's one of these things where I think we need to find ways to bring academics closer to the policy world so they can bring their expertise and then help them make sure that the expertise is brought to bear in ways that actually shape the work that we're doing.
Special thanks to Dr. Powers for taking the time to sit down with Dr. Kluver as part of the OSU Global Briefing Series. That's all from the Inside OSU podcast. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. I'm Robin Hearn. Thanks for listening.